do, with a full heart and without resentment or hustling. A friend I don't know well asked for help with something recently, and all the old impulses kicked in. Of course, I'm your girl, anything for you. And then I waited and breathed and prayed and waited some more. And then I lovingly, kindly disappointed her. And I'm happy to report we both survived. Baby steps. What the lake teaches. This story begins and ends on the water, and our life at the lake is a theme threaded throughout. The water continues to be for me an enduring spiritual image. This book, if it wasn't told in words, could be told in a map, zigzagging all over, coming home to Chicago, and then a solid blue line to the lakeshore town we love, 80 miles across Lake Michigan. It's at the lake that I realize how far I've come, or how far I have yet to travel. Both, maybe. It's at the lake that my priorities reshuffle, aligning more closely with my true nature. I've wondered from time to time if we should move here permanently to this small Michigan town. But it seems to me that we'd bring our bustling and hustling here, and pretty soon we'd need a new place to escape to in order to recalibrate. Part of the magic of the lake is that it isn't home, it's away. And away allows us to see the rhythms and dimensions of our lives more clearly. So it doesn't necessarily work for us to live here at the lake, but I do want the way of living that I've tasted here to inform and ground how I live everywhere all year long. The lake gives me something to aspire to, a reminder, a rhythm, a pattern. Simple, connected to God and His world and people, uncomplicated by lots of stuff. Along this passage, my life has become decidedly less impressive. It has, though, become so much more joyful here on the inside, here where it matters only to me and to the people closest to me. There's less to see. Fewer books being published, fewer events being spoken at, fewer trips, fewer blog posts, fewer parties. And the space that remains is beautiful and peaceful and full of life and connection, what I was looking for all along with all that pushing and proving. In my experience with this process, you have to start with the outsides. That's the only way to begin. So it starts with calendars and concentric circles, lists, saying yes, saying no. And over time, you gain a little breathing room. And with those first deep, beautiful breaths, you begin to peel the next layer. Why am I doing this? What is it in me that keeps things moving so breakneck fast, that believes achieving will keep me safe, that sacrifices my own health and happiness so that people who aren't me will think I'm doing a good job in some vague, moving target kind of way? I tried off and on for the first years of this journey to inch my way towards sanity and peace. And every fall, I fell apart again, having said yes to too many things. I needed more than just a vague intention to slow down a little bit. For some of us, the addiction to motion is so deep, so pervasive, that only dramatic gestures are enough to take hold. A friend of mine told me I was pulling the ripcord on my career by being so outspoken about how badly I didn't want to travel and speak anymore. Didn't I realize the people who were asking me to speak might read my blog and then not invite me? Exactly, I said. That's the plan, I told him. I'm a writer, not a speaker, but I'll never write another book again if I can't get out of this constant cycle of output and exhaustion. I had the sense that my essential self, my best self, was slipping away, and the new person in her place was someone I very much didn't want to be. She was shaped out of necessity, tough and focused enough to bear the weight of my work life, when the real me, tender and whimsical, would have crumpled under the weight. Some of being an adult, though, is about protecting and preserving what we discover to be the best parts of ourselves. And here's a hint. They're almost always the parts we've struggled against for years. They make us weird or different, unusual, but not in a good way. They're our child sides, our innate selves. Not the most productive or competitive or logical, just true. Just us, just very simply who we are, regardless of how much quantitative value they add. It's the perfect weather for writing. Gray, cool, windy. Too sunny and you feel like you're missing out. Too cold and you can't have the balcony door open. And the balcony is the very best part of my temporary little retreat home. When I look across the street, I can see the river, the pilings, the weathered docks. The trees are old and tall, higher than the roof, almost like I'm in a treehouse, and the wind off the river is fresh and whipping. Sometimes a gust spins through the room, and a piece of paper flies off the nightstand, or a door rattles on its hinges. This last weekend was one of the sweetest yet, and part of it certainly owes to my new learning. Memorial Day weekend in the past has been frantic shopping and cooking and menu planning, guests upon guests, plans upon plans, times and places and texts, a chaotic effort to ring in the summer season with one more drink, one more ice cream cone, one more boat ride before falling into bed. And this year, none of that. We stayed on the beach for hours because there's something about the beach that just brings out the best in little kids. Imagination and sand and sun and yelping and tumbling around, all the good stuff. We went to bed early knowing that with all the fun, it would take the little boys some extra time to settle down. We stayed in our pajamas till 11 on Sunday. My cousins, their kids and mine, their parents and mine, all sitting around the Blue House kitchen table, a box of donuts from Golden Brown Bakery and a pot of coffee. We made s'mores and played with sidewalk chalk. We had breakfast tacos from the farmer's market and kept the kids happy with bowls of strawberries outside on the lawn. It was slow, and it was simple, and it was sweeter than I can remember because it felt more like a glass of water than a fire hose. Pride, for years, has told me that I'm strong enough to drink from a fire hose, and gluttony tells me it will all be so delicious. But those voices are liars. The glass of cool water is more lovely and sustaining than the fire hose ever will be. And I'm starting to trust the voices of peace and simplicity more than pride and gluttony. They're leading me well these days. The more I listen to myself, my body, my feelings, the less I listen to the should and the must and the to-do voices, the more I realize that my body and spirit have been whispering all along, but I couldn't hear them over the chaos and noise of the life I'd created. I was addicted to this chaos, but like any addiction, it was damaging to me. Here's what I know. I thought the doing and the busyness would keep me safe. They keep me numb, which is not the same as safe, which isn't even the greatest thing to aspire to. If you're not like me, prone to frantic levels of activity, swirling chaos, fast-moving cycles of overcommitment and resentment, then you might press your face up to the glass of my life with something like wonder and a little confusion. Why don't you? You might suggest gently, just slow down. I understand the question, but I find it's a little bit like asking people who are ruining their life and their health with their addiction to alcohol why they think they're so thirsty. The stillness feels sort of like walking on the ceiling, utterly foreign. What makes sense to me? Pushing. Lists. Responsibility. Action. 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 What's changing my life? Silence. Rest. Letting myself be fragile. Asking for help. This weekend at the lake, Friday and Saturday were clear-skied and gorgeous. We played outside absolutely all day long, morning till night. Sunday, though, and Monday were cloudy. Storms moving through, showers on and off, and that cloud cover fell over us like a soft blanket, slowing us down, urging us toward naps and movies and coloring books. Lake life has those invitations to rest and slowness woven right into the fabric of the days. Rain showers that send us inside, nightfall that lays us down to rest. But so many of us, myself chief among them, have forsaken those natural rhythms and stayed at full speed through the night, through the storms. I think one reason I come alive so thoroughly at the lake in a way I don't at our home deep in the Midwestern suburbs is because I can feel the presence of the natural world here. In a lakeshore town, when it rains, everything changes. When you want to eat, you go to the farmer's market, not the grocery store. And when the lightning crackles across the sky, you run for cover, throwing extra lines on the boats, securing awnings and umbrellas and deck furniture. At home, deep in the suburbs, it would take something along the lines of a true natural disaster to disrupt our well-trod routines and rhythms. I like that life at the lake depends on the sky, the water, the wind. It's raining now. And I love the sound of the drops falling on the awning outside my window. Love the smell of dirt and water. Love the way the rain necessarily slows everything and everyone down just a little. What kept me running? That's the question I keep returning to, the lock I keep fiddling with. I was highly invested in maintaining my reputation as a very capable person. I thought that how other people felt about me, or thought about me, could determine my happiness. When I see that on the page now, staring back at me in black and white, I see how deeply flawed this idea is, how silly even. But this is what I've learned the hard way. What people think about you means nothing in comparison to what you believe about yourself. Essentially, my identity then depended on outward approval, which changes on a dime. So you dance and you please and you placate and you prove. You become a three-ring circus, and in each ring, you're an entirely different performing animal. Anything anyone wants you to be. The crucial journey then, for me, has been from depending on external expectations, down into my own self, deeper still into God's view of me, His love for me that doesn't change, that will not change, that defines and grounds everything. I bet it all on busyness, achievement, being known as responsible, and escaping when those things didn't work. What I see now is what I really wanted was love, grace, connection, peace. When you decide finally to stop running on the fuel of anxiety, desire to prove, shame, fear, deep inadequacy, when you decide to walk away from that fuel for a while, there's nothing but confusion and silence. You're on the side of the road, empty tank, no idea what will propel you forward. It's disorienting, freeing, terrifying. For a while, you just sit contentedly, and contentment is the most foreign concept you know, but you learn it. Shocking as it is, day by day, hour by hour, you sit in your own skin, just being your plain old self, and it's okay, and it's changing everything. After a while, though, you realize you weren't made only for contentment. That's only half the puzzle. The other part is meaning, calling, love. And this is a new conversation, almost like speaking a second language, faltering, tongue-twisting, exhilarating. Part 2, tunnels. We can't trade empty for empty. We must go to the waterfall, for there's a break in the cup that holds love inside us all. David Wilcox. Tunnels. I've always had what I call crazy brain, a mind that runs and spins, that remembers obscure details and whirs in the middle of the night. My mind is quick and clicking, which was a gift in a classroom, and explains why Q&A is my favorite part of every event. But it also runs ahead of me quite often, catastrophizing, overanalyzing, spinning out. As my patron saint, Anne Lamott, says, my mind is a bad neighborhood. I'm not a potter or a dancer. My mind is my only tool, and at the same time, it's my greatest challenge, an overeager puppy, a spinning hamster wheel. In the last few years, there has been, in some moments, a thread of inner violence inside of me. In some moments, I feel such profound self-hatred, and that terrible darkness bleeds out onto everyone around me, the way darkness does. And then at one point, the volume of that inner violence started to scare me. I could recognize it as separate from me, not built on the true materials of my life or circumstances, but more like a curtain dropping, like a virus infecting everything. It became harder and harder to walk well on those days. Even while I knew they were an aberration, I felt that in many ways I was making good progress, inching toward a life marked more by presence and connection and less by exhaustion and competition. But this vein of inner darkness remained, if anything. Maybe it became more visible once I slowed down a little. Maybe it's part of the reason I'd been running. In the springtime, we went to Hawaii. Aaron and I worked for a few days in Honolulu while my in-laws helped out with the kids. And then we spent a few days on Kauai, just the four of us. And those days on Kauai held a true magic for our family. We rented a slate blue Jeep and drove up into the canyons and along the beaches, stopping for shave ice and visiting coffee farms and watching dolphins and turtles dip and emerge again just off the rocks. It was a time of so much sweetness and silliness. We swam and went to playgrounds and farmers markets and fell into bed at night, exhausted and happy. We'd heard that the snorkeling at Tunnels Beach was one of the most extraordinary spots anywhere. So one day we went to Hanalei for fish tacos, watching the kayaks and paddleboards float by on the river, and then on to Tunnels Beach, right on the edge of the Nepali coast. It's called Tunnels because from the air, the reefs look like tunnels running under the water to the shore. We parked at the base of a deeply green mountain, steep and beautiful, and then walked and walked until finally we arrived at this breathtaking underwater lattice of coral, tunnels through the sand, Aaron and Henry put on their masks and snorkels and went exploring first, while Mac and I sat at the edge of the water, letting the gentle waves knock us down 1,000 times in a row, screaming with glee every time. Henry came running back. "Mom, it's amazing. You have to come with me." And so while Aaron played with Mac, my darling 8-year-old boy took me by the hand and we swam out through the tunnels, fins propelling us silently and smoothly. It was as absolutely extraordinary as everyone had told us, deeply blue with bright coral and schools of fish darting and circling us. All the while, Henry held my hand and pointed things out to me, leading me around the shallow coral heads, making sure I saw every brightly colored fish and plant. I knew, even while it was happening, that this was one of those moments that a mother keeps with her forever, a snapshot of impossible sweetness. I told myself to remember absolutely every single thing about it, to stay in it, and soak up every second. And at the very same time, I felt a dagger of such aggressive hatred for myself that I couldn't concentrate. I've been snorkeling since I was a child, but I kept submerging the snorkel, sucking in salty water, sputtering and gasping. I kept shaking my head, trying to snap myself back into the present, into the wonder, into the beauty, but I couldn't. The wave of deep darkness inside me was too powerful to beat back, and while I fought to be there, fully there, I was swept away by a searing hot knife slice of self-hatred running through me. All I could think about was how deeply I hated myself. I was holding my son's hand as he led me through the water, snorkeling at one of the most beautiful beaches in the world, and I was choking on my aggressive, almost violent self-loathing. Something unlocked. When Henry and I got back to the shore, over the kids' heads, I said softly to Aaron, "Something needs to change. I can't live like this anymore. We can't. They can't." He squeezed my hand. "We're on it, baby. Whatever it takes." When we got home, I went back to my counselor, talked about it with the cooking club and the people who know me best. I told the truth as honestly as I could over and over. I kept talking, kept asking for help, kept going back to the counselor, kept learning new ways to heal old wounds. As I dove deeper and deeper into my own heart, my past, my feelings and memories, a few things began to make sense. First, the ongoing chaos, the lifelong preference for busyness and ear-splitting volume. Who wouldn't rather drown out that inner vein of self-hatred? Who wouldn't rather try to outrun it? Who wouldn't simply turn the knob on the stereo and let the music drown it out? Well, maybe some people wouldn't. Maybe some people would stoop down to pet it like a stray cat, pick it up, learn about it. Those people are psychological miracles. I, however, chose to outrun and overstuff my life to avoid the darkness. No wonder silence terrified me. No wonder I ran from activity to activity. That day at the tunnels, I was essentially unarmed. No noise, no activity, no ear-splitting volume, just the water, the coral, my son's small, sweet hand. And so I began to peer into the darkness, that plunging sense of deep inadequacy. It's always been there. Frankly, I didn't know other people didn't have it. I thought that at the center of all of us was black, liquid self-loathing. And that's why we did everything we did. That's why some people became workaholics, and some people eat, and some people drink, and some people have sex with strangers, to avoid that dark sludge of self-loathing at the center of all of us. As I started to talk about this, though, gingerly at first, and then with increasing vulnerability, I realized that not everyone feels this thing I feel. Some people, apparently, feel solid and loved and secure in their most inside, secret parts. What? Well, no wonder. I still didn't understand the solution, but more clearly than ever, I understood the problem. The hustling that had so deeply compromised my heart was an effort to outrun the emptiness and deep insecurity inside me. This was going to have to be, as Anne Lamott says, an inside job. And so I began the daily, unglamorous work of rebuilding that strong inner core, replacing that sludgy hatred with love. Silly as it may sound, I began each morning by picturing a heart, like a red cartoon heart, and I trained my mind on the reality of God's unconditional love for me, for all people, for everything that He's created. When my mind wanders, I gently pull it back to the heart, like a kindergartner would make for Valentine's Day, bright and simple. Over time, the heart began to cover the darkness. My belief in my own worth, because of God's love, began to grow like a just-lit candle, flickery and fragile at first, and then stronger, stronger. And over time, that deep pool of unworthiness receded a little. Another way to say it, I used to believe in the deepest way that there was something irreparably wrong with me, and love was a lie. Now I'm beginning to see that love is the truth, and the darkness is a lie. It used to be that I was my most anxious, jittery, frantic self when I was alone and still, and that makes sense to me now. Essentially, I had a hollow core, and that emptiness became deafening in the stillness. So I ran and ran and talked and spun circles around my life, avoiding that emptiness. What I find now, though, is that the stillness is where I feel safe and grounded, and that the frantic living spins me away from myself, from my center, from my new and very precious awareness of how deeply I'm loved. I return to the silence, to return to love. I can't hear the voice of love when I'm hustling. All I can hear are my own feet pounding the pavement and the sound of other runners about to overtake me, beat me. But competition has no place in my life anymore. The stillness reminds me of that. The longer I practice this new way of praying, of listening, of dwelling deeply in God's love, the more I began to feel truly present, instead of being hijacked 1,000 times a day by my wild mind. I feel all here, collected together in a wide-eyed and able way, simple presence, wholeheartedness, patience, lack of paralyzing fear. I feel, frankly, like the kind of mom and wife and friend I've wanted to be for a long time. Most of my regrets center around getting overwhelmed or stuck in my own head, worried and catastrophizing, endless loops of proving and shame, pushing and exhaustion. I'm thankful for that day, weaving through the tunnels with my precious boy, when the violence inside me became profound enough to shake me into new solutions. That's how we grow, it seems. That's how we submit ourselves to the miraculous, by swimming through the tunnels. Vinegar and oil. My friend Jerry taught me something about prayer many years ago, and the image has stayed with me. She's a New Yorker, the real kind, tough and beautiful, no nonsense and passionate. She told me that when you begin to pray, whether you write your prayers or speak them or form them silently in your mind, picture a bottle of oil and vinegar salad dressing, a cruet like you'd find on the table of an old school Italian restaurant, with a plastic red and white checkered tablecloth and a shaker of hot pepper flakes. The vinegar, probably red wine vinegar, rests on top of the olive oil, softly red, flecked with oregano. The green-yellow oil is at the bottom of the bottle, rich and flavorful. Jerry said that when you begin to pray, pour out the vinegar first, the acid, whatever's troubling you, whatever hurt you, whatever is harsh and jangling your nerves or spirit, you pour that out first. I'm worried about this child, or I'm hurt from this conversation, I'm lonely, I'm scared, I don't know how this thing will even get fixed. Pour out all the vinegar until it's gone. Then what you find underneath is the oil, glistening and thick. We're going to be fine. God is real and good and present and working. This is the oil that women made in the Old Testament, harvesting and pressing olives for this rich green liquid. This is the grounding truth of life with God, that we're connected, that we're not alone, that life is not all vinegar, puckery, and acidic. It is also oil, luscious, thick, heavy with history and flavor. But you have to start with the vinegar, or you'll never experience the oil. Many of us learned along the way to ignore the vinegar. The hot tears banging on our eyelids, the hurt feelings, the fear. Ignore them, stuff them, make yourself numb, and then pray dutiful, happy prayers. But this is what I'm learning about prayer. You don't get the oil until you pour out the vinegar. I have a terrible habit of not praying about things that seem too human, too trivial to me. I get annoyed, frankly, when people pray for parking spaces in a world with so much suffering, so I swing the other way. I'm scared and I'm tired, but I don't say that. I say, I'm sorry I'm so fearful. I'm sorry I've gotten myself into this mess. That's the heart of it. I don't want to pray for anything that I may have caused or that I could undo on my own. I said yes to speaking at this event, and now if I feel scared, that's my own fault. I said yes to this deadline, and now I'm tired and struggling to meet it, but that's my own fault. I'm learning, though, that the God who loves me isn't just looking for apologies and report cards. He wants me to bring the vinegar so that I can taste the oil. He has all the time in the world to sit with me and sift through my fears and feelings and failings. That's what prayer is. That's what love is. And so I begin, feeling a little silly, feeling like so many people I've criticized, inviting God to solve the problems I could solve in my own life with better boundaries and a little elbow grease. But I do it anyway. Here I am, God. I feel scared and fragile, and I worry about my kids. When I'm away from them, I miss them, but when I'm with them, sometimes I feel so impatient with them. I don't like who I am sometimes, and I wonder if anyone really loves me. And as I do it, I can feel my heart release, dropping into the hands of God, who holds it tenderly. And I start to feel connected and loved, even though I'm fragile, even though I'm weak. Maybe because I am. Because I'm not frantically trying to hide the bottle of vinegar. When I admit that it exists, when I bring it to God in prayer and silence, that's when connection can begin. He doesn't ask me to show up and catalog my strengths. He doesn't ask me to show up and abuse myself for my failings. He asks me to bring my whole, fragile, strong, weak, good, bad self. And that starts with vinegar, and it makes a way for oil. This is one of those things I knew how to do as a child. I think we all knew how, as children, to bring our whole selves to relationships or friendships or in prayer with God. But along the way, we learn to only bring our achievements or our desperate apologies for the lack of achievement, as though God is the foreman of the factory punching our time cards. But he isn't. He is love itself, grace embodied, holding the fullness of who we are, strong, weak, good, bad, wild, fearful, brave, silly, in his hands. He can be trusted with every part of it, the silly and the enormous. I've been a Christian who hasn't trusted God with her full self for a long time. I bring him my achievements. I destroy myself for my failings. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But it's only recently that I'm relearning to do what I learned as a child, to bring my whole self without shame and hiding, without pushing and striving. You cannot taste the oil until you pour out the vinegar. And it's okay to admit that there's vinegar. All the small hurts and enormous fears, you pour it out, letting the all-powerful God who knows you and loves you see you as you are. The scariest thing any of us can do, allow ourselves to be seen. I've been afraid to be truly seen for so many years, and I'm relearning to let myself be seen by a holy God, every part, every flaw, unhidden by achievement and by shame. It's a hard enough thing for me to do it with people. It's a harder thing still for me to do it with God, but it changes me, changes us as we do it. It rearranges our molecules, grounding us to the reality of love in a thoroughly new way. I've been ungrounded for so long, attaching to whatever I can, whenever I can, flailing around to feel connected to something bigger than myself. I attach cognitively to the idea of God, but I didn't allow myself to be seen, vinegar and all. And so I cut myself off from the healing oil, from the grounding. You have to pour out the acid before you get to the richness. And you can't get there until you're willing to truly be seen, vinegar and all. A wide and holy space. Try to keep your soul always in peace and quiet, always ready for whatever our Lord may wish to work in you. It is certainly a higher virtue of the soul and a greater grace to be able to enjoy the Lord in different times and different places than in only one. Ignatius of Loyola. Aaron has been a pianist and worship leader since approximately forever, since he started playing piano and singing Keith Green songs in the small church where he grew up. In recent years, though, he's spent less time writing songs, sitting at the piano, and more time reading about liturgy, church history, spiritual formation, and practices. He was bursting with energy and dreams and ideas for new ways of gathering, exploring other traditions and ancient practices. He was reading voraciously and spent hours walking up and down the sidewalk in front of our house, on phone call after phone call with friends around the country, feeling their hearts and minds ignited by similar themes. And then 2 years ago, our church invited him to bring those dreams and ideas to life. He left behind almost 20 years of leading worship in huge rooms, and he drew together a small team of like-minded friends to start the practice. I've never seen him happier, never seen him more connected to his own passion or vocation. We began meeting on Sunday nights in our church's chapel, a beautiful, sacred space. At the center of the room is the Eucharist table. Loaves of bread, slender bottles of dark juice waiting to be poured into bowls, a grand piano, sometimes a cello. We begin in silence, and Aaron leads us through an opening liturgy. We pray and sing. We practice confession and assurance. We learn from rabbis and Jesuits and Pentecostals and spiritual directors. We learn from men and women, old and young, from right within our community and from San Francisco and Tulsa and New York City. We sit in the round, and the rest of the building is dark and hushed. Sometimes we have potlucks in the basement, and on the day of the first one, I was elated. My first church basement potluck. There must have been a dozen crockpots, and I was in my glory. At dinner a few nights ago, a friend I don't see often asked me about the gathering, about what Aaron's doing these days. My friend was raised Catholic, but isn't religious. I told him what Aaron's created is more like the masses he grew up going to in some ways. Creeds, written prayers, hymns, practices that originated in the Catholic Church like Lectio Divina and the Ignatian Prayer of the Imagination. I could see the wheels turning in his mind as I explained. He said, "When I go to your church, it's like a breath of fresh air from what I grew up with." "Exactly," I said, "and this is a breath of fresh air from what we grew up with." I told him it was like we all grow up with half a pie, and part of being an adult person of faith is finding the rest of your pie. I absolutely love our church. It's my sister, my home. My parents started our church the year before I was born, and it's been a constant in my life, a central part of the story of my family and of my own life. This fall, we celebrated the church's 40th anniversary, and it was such a tender, proud moment for my parents and my brother and me. We looked at each other almost in awe that four weirdos like us got to be a part of something so beautiful. We prayed such deeply felt prayers of gratitude, and we drew close to one another, telling old stories, laughing and crying together. And the journey of the practice and the voices we're learning from in that community is helping to fill the other half of the pie, and I'm so thankful for that, too. We attended a Shabbat service at a Reformed synagogue recently because the Jewish tradition has so much to teach us about Sabbath. Even though most of us didn't understand a word of Hebrew in the service, we were welcomed into their community with such warmth that there was no translation necessary. Our friend Ian, an Episcopal priest, taught us something I'd never heard, something that shaped all of us. On a rainy night, with raindrops echoing loudly on the roof, he told us that we never take communion. We receive communion. Taking, he said, is what happened in the garden. Receiving is what will put the world back together again. Ian began his message by reading a long passage from Patti Smith's Just Kids, a book I adore, and it's moving to me that my lifelong love for literature and language finds a place in that dark chapel on Sunday nights. It feels like a coming together of a thousand threads, the Episcopal church I attended in college, the longing I felt as a child to be Catholic, because being a non-Catholic in Chicago is to be an outsider, missing out on Friday fish fries and First Communions, my lit major focusing on modern Jewish and Israeli writing with a special emphasis on the Holocaust. Poetry and music, silence and imagination, a wide and holy space for God to demonstrate his nature to us in all sorts of ways, drawing us nearer, teaching us to see with new eyes. As a reader and a lover of history, it's so meaningful to me to balance the relative youth of my tradition with the deep rootedness of the Catholic tradition or the liturgy or the Book of Common Prayer. I like feeling connected to something durable and beautiful, something that has endured centuries. And it's been so healing for me to have a spiritual place that invites me into depth, into quiet, into silence. The tradition I've grown up in gave me such a respect for learning, for service, for helping people and making the world better. I wouldn't trade those things. And I'm so proud to be a part of a church that's engaged in the world, that's action-oriented and smart. And it's been so valuable to add to those great things a regular practice of silence, prayer, and Sabbath. Again, filling that pie is the work of being an adult Christian, the privilege, really. Many of us rail against what we didn't get, or we rail against what's being offered here or there, that what they're doing isn't perfect and what they're doing over there isn't either. But as a pastor's daughter who spent most of her life in churches, this is what I know. No church is perfect, and the best you can hope for is that each church experience you gather up throughout your life fills that pie a little bit. And in the same way that, for example, most artists aren't super administrative, and most driving leaders aren't profoundly tender, and most engineers aren't big on drama, that's how churches are. Limited, great at a couple things, not so great at the rest. That's how I am. That's how our church is. That's how the practice is. And the way that God has used that Sunday night gathering is one of the things I'm most grateful for in recent years. The new voices and influences that I'm learning from, the new reading and new practices are bringing me to new life spiritually in all sorts of ways. Not because they're better, and not because they're new to me, but because our God is so big, bigger than one church or one way or one tradition, and He uses such a wide and holy variety of people and voices and practices. And for that, I'm profoundly thankful. Daughter, it seems to me that Christians, even more than anyone else, ought to be deeply grounded, living a courageous rhythm of rest, prayer, service, and work. That rhythm is biblical, and it's one that Jesus Himself modeled. It seems to me that Christians ought to be free in meaningful and radical ways to bow out of the culture's insistence on proving and competing. Again, like Jesus. It seems to me that Christians ought to care more deeply about their souls than their bank accounts and pant sizes. But I'm a Christian, and I'm guilty of all these. My faith has not failed me, but I think maybe I have failed it. Our beautiful, historic faith tradition is built on feasts and holidays, Sabbath and evening prayers, a rhythmic, beautiful life with God. And many of us, myself certainly included, have stomped on the accelerator of our own lives and obliterated all evidence of that lovely path laid out for us. But the pattern remains if you squint, if you're willing to be creative, if you're fed up enough with the noise and the speed of the alternative. I believe that certain strains of our faith have led us to this spot. They shouldn't have, of course, but this is what humans do sometimes. Christians have made too much out of work, in the same way that Americans have begun engaging in yoga competitions, twisted up versions of a purer thing. Christians want to make a difference. So we do, and we do, and we do, and then we find ourselves exhausted. In more fundamentalist strains of the faith, there's great value on happiness, constant kindness, selflessness above all else. These are wonderful things that over time make it really hard to say things like, I need help, or I can't do this anymore. Many Christians, women especially, were raised to be obedient and easy, to swallow feelings, to choke down tears. This has not served us well. This has made it far too easy to injure our bodies and our souls in the name of good causes. There are enough good causes to go around. Christians ought to be decidedly anti-frantic, relentlessly present to each moment, profoundly grounded and grateful. Why then am I so tired, so parched, so speed addicted? Again, the fault lies not with the tradition, but with the perversion of it, and with the Christian herself. In this case, of course, me. These days, I'm not looking for more to crusade against or for, but trying to reimagine my faith as a soft place, the antidote to my addiction, not the enabler. I'm trying to relearn a set of patterns from the inside out, centering prayer, Lectio Divina, the prayer of examine. I don't practice these things instead of Bible study, corporate worship, or service, but alongside them, to build an inner core of silence and substance, unshakable in the business of life. I listen more. I picture God's heart red and beautiful. I breathe deeply and try to imagine my faith as protection from this frantic, soulless way of living, instead of one of its motivators. Many of us who have found ourselves to be useful in Christian service have found ourselves unable, if we're honest, to connect with God any other way. We do for Him instead of being with Him. We become soldiers instead of brothers and sisters and daughters and sons. This is dangerous, damaging territory, and I've spent too much time there. These days, I'm relearning daughterness, and I find it most through silence and nature. Nature, of course, connects us back to that innate sense of having been created, of order and beauty and humility. We have been made. We are fragile. We live in connection to water and air and plants and sunshine. And when we acknowledge those things, we acknowledge our Creator. Far too often in the winter especially, the natural world is simply something that disrupts our plans. Flights delayed, schools closed. One snowy morning recently, I felt at loose ends, disconnected from myself and from God. I'd been sick and my mind had been anxious. I practiced Lectio Divina, selecting a passage from Psalm 8. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? As those words began to take root in me, as I read and reread them, as I listened and prayed, I felt my tangled spirit begin to untangle. I felt my breath slow and deepen. I felt a part of the natural world, governed by a good God, created with care and attentiveness. I felt my daughterness, my place in the family of God, and I exhaled. Yellow sky. The sky turned yellow last night, and we watched the weather hour by hour, thunderstorms and tornadoes passing just south of us. We're sleeping hard these nights. Feverish, all four of us, tossing and turning, sweating through sheets, kids yelping and crying out from vivid dreams. The days start a little too early, all four of us stumbling toward coffee and breakfast, clean clothes and where are my shoes. And then as wild and chaotic as the morning is, just as swiftly, they're gone, and the house is silent, and I become a writer. Coffee, candle, laptop. I've always thought of myself as a city girl. I love the energy, the diversity, the noise. I love the variety of experiences, the speed and volume, the endless chatter and din of traffic, the endless options and adventures. But as I learn to dwell in the silence of my own heart, I'm finding myself drawn to the silence of nature, of water, land, expanse. As I learn to trust the stillness I've been running from for so long, I'm finding that I crave more and more silence. I'm drawn back to the water, to the sound of the waves instead of the sounds of traffic and the blare of action and excitement. Yesterday, I sat with my spiritual director. Her name is Mary, and we meet on the second floor of a Jesuit retreat center bordered by horse farms. I slide my hand up the heavy banister, feel the creaking wood stairs beneath me. We sit in a small room with a window, a radiator, two small chairs. On a recent visit, Mary asked me about my prayer life. She asked me specifically to whom I pray and if, when I pray, I sense a physical, embodied presence. I'm surprised at how hard it was to put into words exactly how I pray, especially because Mary and I are from different traditions, and along the way we've sometimes found that we don't always understand one another's terms. And so I fumbled around, telling her essentially that I pray to God, some version between Father and Spirit. Definitely not Jesus, more like the idea of God, philosophically, to the sovereign, divine reality. She looked confused, understandably. Could you pray to Jesus? She asked. Would that be uncomfortable for you? Could you pray to him as though he is right here in this room, a man, alive, with a body? I could do that, I told her. I couldn't figure out exactly why I didn't pray that way, and I kept thinking about it for several days. I talked about it with a wise friend, and as we talked, I understood a little more. I love being a Christian, but I think sometimes I err on the side of believing in the ideals, or on the other side, connecting with God through his creation, through the face of a child or the words of a friend or the color of the sky. The ideals and the tactile stuff of the world, yes, but the person of Christ, almost not at all. I don't think that's particularly indicative of my church or my tradition. I think that might be just me, and I wanted to figure out why. As my friend asked me more about it, I think what might lie beneath that sort of middle, missing layer of prayer is my own discomfort with need, my need. Jesus, when I think of him, is the face of such love, such deep connection. It makes me feel uncomfortable with my own need, with needs that I don't want to admit to having. One confession. More often than not, I found myself praying some version of, You got yourself into this, you get yourself out. When I'm tired from too much traveling, when I'm about to walk out on stage to speak, when I feel scared about the enormity of a room or an opportunity, something inside me tells me I can't pray for things that I've selected into and now need help with. If I'm honest, my theology of prayer seems to be, you made your bed, now lie in it. But in the last year, I've been tiptoeing back into need, into admitting need, admitting that I need help. Just as I'd developed all kinds of defenses so that I didn't have to connect deeply with fear or anxiety or complicated relational dynamics, I'd done the same thing in my spiritual life. I was a good soldier, a responsible daughter, a trustworthy servant, but I was not a deeply loved friend or trusting and fragile daughter. In the same way that I didn't allow myself to be taken care of by people, I didn't know how to let myself be taken care of by God. Honestly, even that phrase makes me uncomfortable. But I know that discomfort is often the way through, and so I began, picturing the face of Jesus, a person, a friend, someone who loves me, knows me, sees me. And I began asking for help, for all sorts of things that I didn't feel I deserved to ask for. Energy when I was depleted, patience when I was spent, courage when I was afraid. And every time, I'll be honest, it was uncomfortable, like anything you're learning. Awkward at first, fumbling. I have no trouble at all praying for other people. I love to pray for other people, for big things and small things, matters of great consequence. But I'm just beginning to get comfortable once again, after many years of distance, to pray the contents of my own heart, the needs and longings of my own spirit. It feels awkward sometimes, and it feels life-changing. I sat with Mary again recently. We prayed together, and at the end of our time together, she leaned forward and said, "You're ready. I can sense it. You're ready to truly know Jesus in a deeper way. Start with being. Start with silence." She lowered her voice to a whisper. "Be not afraid, my dear one. He says, be still and know that I am God. Be still and know. Be still. Be. It just starts with be. Just be, dear one." On stillness. I said to my soul, "Be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. Yet there is faith. But the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing." T.S. Eliot, East Coker, Four Quartets. One of the reasons I believe in God is because I can see so clearly His loving and hilarious hand guiding us to the unlikeliest of places to find the healing we've been searching for all along. Why am I a writer of all possible things? I hate silence, stillness, introspection. When's lunch? My lifelong love affair with stories and words has brought me to stillness, proving once again that God has both a sense of humor and a sense of outrageous grace. The word stillness, of course, brings me to Eliot, with whom I fell in love as a young reader many years ago. "The only way through the emptiness is stillness. Staring at that deep wound unflinchingly, you can't outrun anything. I've tried. All you can do is show up in the stillness." And the grounding, the healing, I'm finding that it happens in silence. I don't want this to be true. I want there to be silence people and noise people, and God mostly reveals Himself to me at parties and while I'm watching TV and reading and the music's playing really loud. I feel sometimes like the last extrovert on earth, the last girl on the dance floor, the last person to finally own up to the fact that true silence can't be avoided if you want to be a truly connected spiritual person. I've basically spent all my life avoiding true silence. But it's in the silence that you can finally allow yourself to be seen. And it's in the being seen that healing and groundedness can begin. When I practice silence just for a few minutes, when I practice allowing myself to be seen and loved by the God who created me from dust, I start to carry an inner stillness with me back into the noise like a secret. There's a quiet place inside me that I bring with me. And when I start to feel the questions, the fear, the chaos, I locate that quiet, that stillness, that grounded place. When you begin to carry God's love and true peace deep within your actual soul, like a treasure chest, you realize that you don't have to fling yourself around the planet searching for those things outside yourself. You only have to go back into the stillness to locate it. That treasure you've been searching for so long was there all the time. Stars. What has led me here was not one snap your fingers before and after change. Instead, there have been 1,000 little reasons and voices, whispers and suggestions. It's like when you're walking in Times Square or Piccadilly Circus and every few feet someone gives you a postcard or a leaflet, an invitation to something, a show or a club, every few steps an invitation, then another, until finally there were so many invitations I could fan them out like a dealer with a deck of cards on a table in Vegas. And I realized that my answer to all these invitations was yes. Yes, I will lay down this frantic way of living. Yes, I will show up to the event that I've been invited to. This event, of course, is my life. But for now, I'm learning so much through the silence and the space created in its absence. My crazy brain has always been my gift and my challenge, and I've tried everything to lower the volume in my head because things really do get a little loud in there. What I'm finding, though, is that it's my job to lower the volume just enough so that my ears don't bleed. And so that I can hear the music of my life. I'm an avoider, an escaper, an anywhere but here with all my thoughts and feelings kind of person. While I want so deeply and desperately to live right in the actual messy, gritty, fabulous, ridiculous present, I've got a whole arsenal of tricks to eject me out of it. My earliest escape route stories, then food, then drinking, then working, then achieving, all the things we hold out as armor, insulating us from the pain and mess and fear. But the pain and the mess and the fear are the fabric of actual life, woven amid love and parenting and bedtime and laundry and work. When you insulate yourself from some of it, you insulate yourself from all of it. And I want to be right in it, painful or not, scary or not. As my friend Glennon says, unarmed. I've been armed for as long as I can remember, a veritable bunker of books and meals and drinks and to-do lists. They looked like real life, but upon closer inspection, they were my armor against it. And in this season, this unabashedly midlife passage, I'm laying down my arms, opening my hands to mix the metaphors thoroughly. I love the simplicity of this season. It's noticeably quiet, and I'm surprised to find how much I like it. I've been terrified of silence all my life. And for the first time, I'm finding it beautiful. Aaron, of course, is a musician, a pianist, a songwriter, a singer, but his musical soul, really, is all about the groove, the rhythm. His all-time favorite bass players play relatively few notes, and the beautiful thing they make is all about the space in between the notes. That's the groove. In this season, I'm finding so much beauty in the space between the notes. This is new for me. This is life-changing. For the first time, I'm able to stay in the space right inside the silence, held there, mesmerized, content, empty. If you believe that people can't change, I'm here to tell you we can. If you think you could never turn down the volume or lay down your armor or climb into the silence, I'm here to tell you that if I can, you can. If I can, anyone can. I'm a hardened case, a tough nut to crack, a lifelong connoisseur of noise and motion and excessiveness of any kind. If I can climb into silence and simplicity, anyone on earth can join me there, I promise. Sometimes I read books about the contemplative life, but it seems to me they're always written by, you know, contemplative people, people who love to be alone, whose lives have always been calibrated by silence and simplicity. I'm not sure that helps me. So here I am, a girl who loves the days that scream along from start to finish, that start with loads of espresso and switch quickly to wine with lunch. And I'm telling you that the silence is becoming my new home, that the tenderness of life unarmed is welcoming me into the sweetest season of life I've yet known. I did not see this coming, honestly. But I suppose I should have, because God in his goodness has been doing this thing in my life for a long time, surprising me, drawing me along to places I could never have imagined. Whatever it is you think you can't do without, alcohol, shopping, that number on a scale, that car, that secret habit, that workout, the pills, the lies, the affair, the money, the success, the cutting, whatever it is that you clutch onto with angry fists, that you grab like a lifeline, when you release that thing, when you let it go, that's when you'll hear the notes between the music. That's when you'll feel the groove, the rhythm you were made to feel, that you've covered over 1,000 times with noise and motion and fear and all the things. When you hear it, you'll realize it sounds a lot like your own heartbeat. The rhythm of God, of life, pumping in your chest, the most beautiful song you've ever heard. The morning I decided to dive even more deeply and honestly into the practice of silence, I bought myself a necklace with a tiny star on a fine gold chain. Something about the star felt meaningful to me. Delicate, powerful, rising, constant, lighting the dark in a small but glittering way. Several times a day, my fingers find the tiny star around my neck. A symbol of doing something difficult and valuable. I went to see my counselor to talk to him once again about laying down all the things that keep me full and frantic and distracted and exhausted. He said he was proud of me. And at the end of our time together, he said, "What you're saying reminds me of the journey. Remember that poem?" And together we rambled around an approximation of Mary Oliver's gorgeous poem, The Wild Night, the voices, bad advice, "Mend my life," they cried. But then you knew what you had to do. And when he got to the part about the stars burning through, my eyes filled with tears and I showed him my necklace. "Stars," I said. "In the city, you can't see the stars for the city lights, but at the lake and in the country, the stars are so bright you can practically read by them. And that's what I'm finding. When I get out of the city, the noise and the chaos, the screaming intensity, then I can see the stars. And they're beautiful." Part 3, Legacy. You wander from room to room, hunting for the diamond necklace that is already around your neck. Rumi. Agency. Essentially, what I'm talking about, what I'm circling ever nearer and nearer to, is agency. Or maybe authority. Owning one's life for better and for worse. Saying out loud, "This is who I am. This is who I'm not. This is what I want. This is what I'm leaving behind." In my experience, our culture teaches men to do this quite well. Women, it seems, have a much trickier time with it. It's only quite recently that women have even been permitted to ask these questions, and we're just getting the hang of it, many of us, fumbling and awkward. "Really? Really? Me? Are you sure?" Yes, darling, I'm sure. You get to tell the truth about what you love and who you are and what you dream about. We'll learn this new path together. What I'm learning is that you have to stop doing a whole lot of things to learn what it is you really love, who it is you really are. Many of us go years and years without even asking these questions because the lives we've fallen into have told us exactly who to be and what to love and what to give ourselves to. As I look back, in many instances, I simply followed the natural course of things. And great things happened, mostly. But over time, I realized they weren't necessarily great things for me. They were maybe someone else's great things, and I was both taking up the space that was meant for them and not standing in my own space, like wearing someone else's shoes, leaving them barefoot. Along the way, I've realized most of the hard work during my last couple seasons has been claiming authority over my own life. This is not a group decision. We're not voting for most this or most that in our yearbooks. This is actually my life, and it doesn't matter a bit if it would be lovely for someone else to live. What does matter? Does it feel congruent with how God made me and called me? Some of us are made to be faster and some slower. Some of us louder and some quieter. Some of us are made to build things and nurture things. Some of us are made to write songs and grants and novels, all different things. And I'm finding that one of the greatest delights in life is walking away from what someone told you you should be in favor of walking toward what you truly love in your own heart, in your own secret soul. I thought I needed to be fast and efficient, sparkly and shiny, battle ready and inexhaustible. There was, I will be honest with you, a lot of pressure from all sorts of places. I could be those things, and so I was. And then lots of people told me I had a responsibility to do more and more and more. For a long time, I listened to them. But what I've learned the hard way is you don't answer to a wide swath of people and their opinions, even if they're good people with good opinions. You were made by hand with great love by the God of the universe, and he planted deep inside of you a set of loves and dreams and idiosyncrasies, and you can ignore them as long